Today on Hear Us Out, we're thrilled to welcome Josh Clark, who has many talents in the world of sound. Josh is an audio engineer, composer, drummer, lecturer, and the founder of Get Real Audio, where his mission is all about capturing sound with honesty and intention. He's worked front of house for live shows, he's shaped recordings behind the board, and collaborated with our recent guest, virtuoso guitarist Mike Dawes, bringing a sharp ear and musical sensitivity to every project. Whether he's mixing a live set, composing original work, or mentoring the next generation of audio professionals, Josh brings a rare blend of technical mastery and creativity. Today, we're diving into the craft of listening, the role of authenticity in audio and performance, and what it really means to get real in music, in sound, and in life. Josh, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Hi, what a lovely introduction. Thank you.
So why don't we start by having you tell us, what does it mean to you to get real when it comes to mixing and sound recording?
Let's start with the name thing. That actually came from a friend of mine who I've been working with probably the longest time. He's a five-string banjo player, a British five-string banjo player called Leon Hunt. And he had a production company with another colleague called Real Productions in the 90s. So real, I like that phrase simply because everything I was doing at the time of coining the company name was, like you say, honesty. You know, I was really into really clear sounding, honest reproductions. I have to say that's maybe been slightly eroded over the years as fashions have changed and my tastes have changed. And maybe we like to make acoustic music punch a bit harder these days, but but I still, some of my favorite recordings to listen to are the most pure, the most open sounding. So I like to recalibrate with those things. I tell you what, a favorite thing of mine to do, and I've been working really, really hard, is to go to see a concert that has no loudspeakers in it, whether that be an orchestral large scale concert or, a traditional music duo with, you know, 30 person space, you know, something like that. And it's complete recalibration. You just all your senses are awake.
In those sort of settings, what are you specifically listening for?
I suppose I'm listening for realness, but of course my science brain takes over a little bit and I'm listening to the drop off in high frequencies, depending on where I'm sat and how reverberations really work as well. You know, as somebody who's sat in front of a digital representation of reverberation all day, perhaps recordings of ambience in larger spaces, trying to remember what it is to be immersed in a space and where the reflections are coming from and how it feels to actually be present in those situations. And a lot of what we're doing, I suppose, in acoustic recording is to try and replicate spaces with various degrees of enhancement on that to try and make it sort of, you know, very forward sounding.
You mentioned your scientific mind. Did most of your expertise on audio work come from being self-taught? Was it on the job training? How did your knowledge evolve over time?
It's totally on the job. I studied an undergraduate degree at Bath Spa University, where Mike also studied maybe 10 years later than me. And it was called Creative Music Technology. And not sure it was exactly what I was expecting it to be. It became a really great course, but I was in one of the first couple of years it ran. And it was very sort of avant-garde music concrete and what came about, you know, the modern American composers, Meredith Monk and Philip Glass, and all that. And it wasn't really, I wanted to learn engineering skills. You know, I wanted to be sat behind an SSL just learning how to operate it. So all that came later, and I ended up working for the university. I think I was 23 when I started working there as a, they developed a new role that year called a technical demonstrator, which was partway between, you know, a lab coat wearing technician that mended things and set up the projector and a lecturer. So it was the best of both worlds. So I was hands on with a soldering iron half the day and then in the classroom, either assisting a class or delivering content the other half of the day. And we built the studio complex there in about 2005. I was kind of in the advisory role on the board of, you know, designers that put the thing together, but most of the credit goes to a company called Studio Wizard. The owners, I don't know where they're based now, but the owner lives in France, and they put the whole thing together, and I just worked on the team and learned so much about, you know, studio signals flow and how to piece the thing together, you know, good, you know, patch bay layout techniques, all that kind of stuff. So I ended up getting an interest in studio design that way. But I think from then on, teaching in that space that I'd been a part of designing was really where all the learning happened. And the university were amazing at letting me, you know, develop my own career to the point where I started dropping a day a week to the point where I didn't work there anymore.
You said something that I thought was really interesting in the context earlier of going to environments to listen, to be at that 30-person venue or listen to the live orchestra. I always think for doctors, it's important to be a patient every so often so you can remember what it's like to be on the other side of that interaction. I think with sound, there's some similarities that in a studio, front of house, whatever it may be, so much work in thinking about the technicals to get it right for your audience. But then also remember, what does it mean to be a part of that audience? And when you find yourself in an audience, do you find yourself technically analyzing or do you find yourself just able to enjoy the music?
Yeah, it's difficult to turn the job off, isn't it? I suppose it depends on what the music is. You know, if I'm going to see something that's a nostalgic band from my teens or something, then I'm completely inside the songs. I'm not listening to anything much, except if I think, wow, they're really bringing the A game still. You know, they're all in their 60s now, and this is sounding amazing. So, yeah, obviously, I'm always listening to an extent, but I think it's important to maintain that fandom and consumer level listening experience. You know, on top of my meter bridge is a little tiny Bose Bluetooth speaker, which is the sort of thing that most people just have kicking around their house as their listening world these days. It's kind of, the hi-fi has been eroded. And I just think it's important to make sure everything works at a real level. I mean, this is just normal mixing and mastering technique, to listen to the loud levels and quiet levels. But I like listening to music through my top speakers while I'm doing the washing up. You know, it's just normal. It's what people do. Yes, of course, it's a completely different experience from, a beautifully set up immersive audio system, but it's as valid. And I think if songs shine through that process, then everything we did to make those songs accessible to people was the right process. Yeah, I think it's just about boiling things down. As I get older and more experienced in this, I'm really listening to songs and I'm ignoring anything I've ever learned about technique and technology, trying to make things as simple as possible. The same with live show, it's the same sort of experience, really. I jumped into live quite recently. I had been a mastering engineer, I think, for 8 years or so before I got the call to jump on a tour and mix it. I dabbled, but it was certainly a new experience for me. And by the time I got involved, you needed to be a network engineer to even get close to that equipment and workflow. And so it was a real baptism of fire. But what I did bring to it was an experience of listening that all the young, very professional guys were bringing to the table, but I came in as this grand old wizard of listening. Wow, you can hear this, that, and the other. Yeah, but can you show me how that thing works? Because I got no idea.
Can you tell us what drew you to want to take that on? I feel like once people are accustomed to what they know, the environments that they're comfortable with, it's less easy to venture out into something completely new out of your realm. What made you decide that's a challenge you want to take on, starting the lives?
I was worried about it. So the call that I mentioned is an English folk singer called Kate Rusby, who's dearly loved over here. And she and Mike Dawes, I suppose, are kind of like equal success levels that I work with. Kate's been, she's 30 years deep into her career and 25 albums, that kind of thing. And I've been working, mixing her albums to start with. And then I started tracking them. And then I started playing drums on them as well, because I was already in the room and all that. And then she said, my previous engineer is, starting to move away from the setup and he's recommended you, which is pretty nice of him. And I was at a point at the university where I thought, actually, my work here is kind of done and I'd like to have a new challenge. And I was concerned, like you say, about being a studio guy, and I mix and I master and still do quite a lot of tracking. And I had a couple of conversations, and one of them was with an engineer called David Sinko, who's, I'm not quite sure where he's based, he's US based, but not quite sure where. His main job at the time, he may still do it, was the Punch Brothers, who were, an incredible acoustic music act from the north of the States. And he does both. He's a mixing engineer. He doesn't do loads of mastering, but he does mastering. And he's an incredible live engineer. I'd seen him a few times. And we had a few to and fro's on, I think it was Twitter Messenger back then, about it all. And he completely put any fears to sleep, really. He says, you know how to listen, and that's the main thing. And I think the freshness I brought to the setup, the fact that I wasn't used to doing things, I wasn't conforming to the norms of live audio, put it that way. I walked in and I said, well, I think it should sound like this. And everyone's going, oh, actually, that's a great idea. There was a lot to learn, but I quite enjoyed it. But I don't think there's too much of a challenge, actually, that to go from studio in the various studio disciplines to a live setup. I think they're more interchangeable than people think.
What were some of those differences that you were bringing to that to that live sound that may not have been kind of following the pattern?
I think I was just a lot more discerning about loudspeakers. I think a lot of people I was working with were very into the equipment and not necessarily listening to it so hard. Mm-hmm. It's that whole thing, the difference between using a line array speaker or a point source, if you can possibly get away with it. And I was lucky to work with a great company, actually, who've been doing Kate Rusby's production for many, many years, long before I got involved. They're called Isophase Audio, based in Pontefract in the north of England. And they just did things a little bit differently. They weren't buying, because they're a PA hire company, essentially. They weren't buying L-Acoustics or D&B. I think they had that kind of stuff in the past. They were buying into, what was the first company? Oh, I can't remember. There was a German manufacturer they were using. That sounded amazing to me. And I was like, oh, okay, this is different. You know, this isn't, you know, it doesn't have all the problems of line array equipment. We do like something like 1,500, 2,000 seater theaters. It's that kind of, you know, medium large theaters. And we were finding that we didn't need to put line array in for it, for the kind of show it was. We were just, you know, putting very well placed, very carefully considered boxes. And I'm not saying we did this by ear, you know, we were using appropriate calc software and all that kind of stuff, but I just found that that kind of loudspeaker sounded better to me. But I walked in with a mastering mindset, you know, I'm used to this thing in the beautiful PMC, ATC, you know, very, very good loudspeakers in very good spaces. And I walked in and I wanted them to sound like that. And until they did, I wasn't happy. And so they all thought I was quite picky and right.
Only because you want the best.
I want the best. I want it to sound like, I want every theater to sound like a mastering room.
I don't know why I really like asking this question, but what do you do? The challenge of live is that not everything always goes according to plan. How do you adapt when something goes wrong mid-show?
Yeah, that's a good question. I suppose I've always worked in a live environment as a musician, so it's not alien to me. You know, that I've always had this kind of interesting thought that, you know, as musicians, when we get on a stage and a piece of music begins, there's not an awful lot that could happen that would make us prematurely end that piece of music. We're going to get to the end, you know, whether it goes how we planned or not, if something's going to happen and you'll come out at the end of it. And yeah, there've been all kinds of things. I really like the part of your brain that switches on when there's a challenge that needs to be solved and you've got 30 seconds to do it. And I find that exciting. And I think that's maybe one of the things I was missing from the studio world that I now have and I get to do. I mean, there was one example. We played a festival and we take all our own production in. So we have front of house console. We do monitors from front of house because it's all IEMs, same mix every night. Don't really need to have a monitor engineer. And we got given a house Cat5 cable, I think it was, on that console. And it kind of connected and then it didn't. And then we couldn't get the line check down and we realized there was going to be no show. Until we just sort of like scrabbled through the back of the rack and found this bit of, you know, standard networking cable that happened to be shorter than the house Cat5 cable. And we tried it, plugged it in, did the show on that, and it worked. And it was literally 1 minute to show time. And we line checked in that minute, got on stage on time. And we're doing that festival again in a few weeks. So that story's come up a few times recently.
I want to go back to, again, something earlier that you had said. When you're listening, when you're part of an audience, when you're listening to kind of true acoustic music, maybe unamplified sound beyond the box of the guitar, that's one end of music. And now today, the idea of AI becoming a part of recording and mixing more so than it ever has. What's your perspective on that? And what sort of influence, good or bad, do you think this technology is having in the fields of sound?
It's an interesting thing. I try very hard to stay up to date, but there are limits. You know, I'm probably older than my years in terms of the type of gear I used. I trained at a really beautiful time. I went to, we call it sixth form college over here. I suppose it's like high school age, 16 to 18, 1996, the year that the brick wall limiter was invented. And kind of before anybody had mixed a hit song on Pro Tools, but Pro Tools existed. So we had a Pro Tools system. Every workstation had Cubase VST or something like that. Here we could do four channels of audio. Our Pro Tools rig could do eight channels of audio. It wasn't particularly expensive. And we had a 24-track tech machine and a studio full of outboard. And learning all that stuff side by side did give me a maybe slightly old-fashioned approach, but also the benefit of that history. And I think anybody who learned simply at a DAW, particularly in the early noughties when DAWs were almost entirely designed to try and emulate an analog studio, just before things like Ableton Live came along and kind of broke the mold a bit. I found it because I was teaching that stuff in those days and I found it really hard to teach. And until we got into a studio where there was a board and I was like, okay, this is what it's supposed to look like. And now I can show you in Pro Tools what that means. But yeah, moving forward to the AI thing, there are some plugins which have come along, and so far, as far as plugins are concerned, they appear to be fairly dumb. You know, they're taught stuff in the design process, sure, but they're not doing any kind of active AI work. I see them as some sort of nostalgia engine. Like they might be able to access the history of recorded music and take some sort of input from that data and impress it upon your own music, maybe in terms of EQ, compression, that sort of thing. But I personally haven't yet used anything really, really exciting. I'm not that interested in the kind of things that will deconstruct stems, although I can see that that would be useful in restoring old recordings, for example. That would be an interesting tool to try. I'm so busy, I just don't have time to kind of invest. But yeah, we talk about it all the time. My bandmate in Kate Rusby's band, I'm now, by the way, now her drummer, not her front of house engineer. Which is
my a lot of hats you wear.
Yeah, it's hard to keep up sometimes. My bandmate is an accordion player in her band, but he's also a mastering engineer. He used to work for Sony in London, and now he has his own place. And so, of course, our conversations are usually pretty nerdy. And that stuff comes up quite regularly in conversation about what it will mean to us and going forward. And one thing that's interesting, actually, he does an awful lot of work for library music, production libraries. Still, actually, the company he used to work for, Sony Extreme, I think he still does a lot of work for them and Sky, people like that. And I think that's a much bigger conversation in that world, because it's the kind of music that possibly could be generated, you know, entirely by AI quite soon. And I think composers in that world, which is another thing I've dabbled in, would maybe be a bit more frightened than the kind of thing I do, which is, you know, it's ripping their heart out and playing, you know, porting it through a mandolin. You know, it's very, very hard at the moment to see a way that that would be replaced. And I think there'll be a backlash as well. More and more people will want to know that it's definitely not AI as AI becomes.
Yeah, I wonder if it'll be a bifurcated world where you have kind of sound purists and then you have technologists who are creating sound and just different ways of going
probably
about it.
Probably room for both out there.
Yeah.
That could be an interesting development. You know, we see a friend of mine had a birthday the other day and another friend just made an AI song for him all about him and his life. It was like a country song, put it on the WhatsApp group. And that was kind of funny. And that's fine. You know, that kind of makes sense. And it's what will be interesting is further down the line when the avant-garde gets hold of it, you know, like they did with tape machines, and they were created for, you know, pure reasons and then got completely mangled into something else, and tape loops arrived. And with every technology comes a way of breaking it or using it for a purpose it wasn't designed for. So I'm looking forward to seeing what that is.
And speaking of incorporating technology into recording and mixing work, when we were speaking with Mike, he was talking about sitting down with you to mix his live recording and how there was somebody who was coughing and you were using a spectrum analyzer to, and you're able to identify the coughs within that recording. I wanted to hear about that from your perspective and how it is working with that technology. And then also when you're sitting down to mix that live recording, what are you listening for? Because you know what he sounds like. And then you have this idea, I would think, of what you're trying to replicate. How do you work within that?
I mean, live recordings are a wonderful medium. I think if you can try and get a listener to believe they're in the space. And I've heard some really early live recordings, which really are that. I feel like I'm in the room and it's like being ported back in time to the late 60s. However real those live recordings are, because we know how live recordings work, you know, very, very few live albums ever are entirely live. And, you know, Mike's one is mostly live. Every now and again, there'd be something like, oh, I missed a kick drum. Can we just go in and do that?
Interesting. You know,
that tiny little thing that the transient event of the live concert, you know, all kinds of mistakes and, you know, technical errors can be forgiven, because the next thing that happens is more exciting and you're involved and you're there and it's in the now. And I think to make a live recording stand up to repeated listens in the living room requires a little bit of refining, and everybody is fine with that. I don't think it's a dirty secret anymore. But working with Mike generally, not just on the live recordings, is an incredible experience, actually. So he was a student at the university where I worked, and the dean of faculty who recorded some work for him said, oh, I'm out of my depth here. You know, Mike's instrument really quiet and all I got is noise. And he handed it over to me knowing I could do a better job of it. And that was the beginning of 17 years of brilliant work. Maybe not quite that long. But what Mike has is an incredible attention to detail. One that I'm usually like, you know what? The warts are kind of what makes it interesting and interactive. And he's like, no, I need it to be perfect. And I want it to be amazing. And the great thing about him is when you see him play a gig, it is perfect. It's incredible. he comes to me with these very, very early arrangements. Like, he might have just finished the last section the previous night, and he gets through them. You know, he's like, okay, right, I think I've got this thing. It's going to work great live, because he knows he can do it. And he wouldn't ever record something he couldn't actually pull off. But we go in to forensic detail, and the piece of software that's been valuable to us has been Isotope RX, which, you know, we all use for different purposes. We've been considering actually talking to Isotope about what we do with it, because they developed like a guitar de-chirping tool. It doesn't even touch what we do. It either completely wipes things out, or it doesn't. The threshold situation doesn't really work for us. So everything we do is completely manual and very, very painstaking.
Does his instrument, his physical instrument, create its own set of difficulties because you're working with four amps again within this tiny space?
Well, so because of the way he plays his guitar, the luthier, in fact, he's worked with two luthiers in the time that we've been working together. And the instrument he has now has been built with quite hefty bracing, simply to stand up to the abuse it gets from him, and also to stop it from, to make it stable tuning wise, even though he's hitting it and, you know, playing every tiny thing that makes a sound on it. And because of that, the instrument is naturally very quiet. Now, when we first started working together, I captured the pickups, but it was kind of an afterthought. And it's the same with recording any acoustic instrument. Yeah, I'll record the pickup. We'll see if it's useful. And I was doing everything with microphones. And I think, just trying to add them up in my brain, I think it's something like 12 or 14 channels is our standard recording setup for mic. It's pretty complex. We're planning to do a video about it at some point, but we've been saying that for years. But there's all, you know, mics all over the shop. And there's ambient mics and closed mics and lots of closed mics. And there's also his pickups, which we also multiply outside the box to go through various effects individually. We use like, this one just sat right here. There's this pedal, which is a really cheap, like £20 effects pedal. What's it called? American Sound. It's like a, supposed to be like an amp simulator, but it's just got a drive that we like. He found it, I bought one. They're really, really cheap. And we have an octave divider. It's the Boss OC3 or OC5 we use. So then we do all that outside the box and record it all in. But more recently, we've been leaning more heavily on the pickups. I mean, in his current guitar, they sound incredible, and he's worked really hard on the design of the pickups. I think he worked with Larry DiMarzio on the Soundhole magnetic pickup, and it's just like, doesn't sound that realistic. But then again, we're not specifically trying to go for pure acoustic guitar. You know, he's not John Renborn. You know, it's a different kind of thing. And his early brief to me was, can you make I sound like a metal band?
Okay.
It's kind of been the essay title the whole time is, you know, can we make this one pretty quiet sounding musical instrument, you know, absolutely filled, you know, and the kind of music he listens to and is in the field of is modern metal music. And when we're traveling around, we'll listen to Sleep Token and Bill Murray and, you know, those kind of bands. And he wants to exist in that sphere. And I like it. It's a really good challenge. But the great thing about working with Mike is that he has taught me that I can do more than I think I can the whole time. And I early days, I'd say, I'm not sure we can do that. Maybe with an eye on the time budget of the project. Mm-hmm. Thinking, okay, I probably could give him a couple of days, but we need to finish this song today. And actually, he's kind of like pushed and said, give it a shot. Let's see. And more than half the time, it's been achievable and more easily than I thought it would be. So I've got a lot to thank him for in terms of just pushing away and making sure to get in every last ounce of talent out of me.
Do either you or the two of you, when you're working together, ever come across what I guess what I would call the equivalent of writer's block, of when you're trying to accomplish something and you can't quite figure out the best way to go about it and you're almost in a stuck moment? And if that's happened, how do you get around that?
I mean, every project's got those tricky situations where, you know, you might let something get through. He's got a very high level of quality control, so I don't think we'd ever let anything get through the net that wasn't incredible. I'm trying to remember if we did drop a single once. He released a single before this latest album. It was a few years before. I think there was an assumption it would make the album. And this is kind of how we work. We do a song and then leave it a few months and do another one. We go to the studio for a month and make a record. That's not how we work. And I think that was going to make the album. But I was in my old studio down in the center of Bath, and there had been some sort of noise problem down there that day. It meant we had to decamp to my house. I've never checked out the power situation in that house because I've never done any recording in it. And I can't remember quite what went wrong, but the main microphone pair sounded really strange. And it seemed to have like another waveform overlaid on top of it, which wasn't 50 hertz main sum. I haven't worked it out. But anyway, it sounded weird. He didn't like it. He released it as a single, but we didn't make it to the album. So that, I think, maybe was one of the things that was probably the sort of the worst mistake we made at any point. But there have been other challenges, things like, he has some other guitars that have really difficult intonation issues and just trying to, you know, on the day he's got me on, you know, intonation check, and I've got a pretty good sense of pitch. So I'll go in and say that isn't quite right. I know you're not going to be happy with it, and we'll just tune for one section and we'll just play that over and over again and we'll slot it in. But I think beyond that, no, we've been pretty good about making sure it's perfect every single time. But the things that we can solve are, it's RX, Isotope RX, and also Melodyne DNA has been a lifesaver. Again, it's one of those things I think it's not going to work, and then we do it and actually it's fine.
Can you talk about the differences in a working relationship with somebody like Mike, where it sounds like the two of you just know the way the other is thinking about sound, versus working with somebody new who you may not have that familiarity with? What is that experience?
Yeah. The longer I do this, so I mean, these days, if I get a microphone, I seem to be able to just plonk it down and it sounds amazing. I don't have to think about that stuff anymore. I do still think about it because it's what I'm into, but it's good sounds come out of things, and keeping it simple is the key. So I don't really concentrate on that anymore. When I was in my 20s, it was all I could think about was, oh my god, I need to get the microphone arrays right, and what are the polar patterns doing, and you know, where is everybody else at? I just seemed that's second nature, and it's about, you know, time at it. And now all I'm interested in is personal relationships, what makes them tick, what's going to get the best out them performance wise and yeah, working with somebody new, the hardest thing is really trying to work out how long they're going to need to achieve the result they want. Because I know how fast I can work, but I have no idea if they can, you know, deliver consistent results. Most people have got a falling off point in a day. And if it's only them and they haven't got somebody else that they can say, oh, can you just do a couple of bass takes now or whatever, then, you know, come 3 o'clock, there might be an emotional wreck and no more performing is going to happen. And it's just fascinating to me, yeah, working with people and seeing what they do. And everyone's completely different. There are some commonalities, you know, the post-lunch slump, how people sound before or after they've eaten, their caffeine intake, you know, all those kinds of things are just super important. But making them comfortable, my studio is like a living room, and it's I want people to walk up. Oh, by the way, it's in a castle. So Mike might have mentioned,
awesome.
Yeah, so people rock up to the car park, they've already got this beaming smile, and it's a great way to start the day. It's, wow! So it's like being in a fairy tale, and they come inside and it feels like their living room. And I think
that's wild.
Yeah, that the sort of I've always found the glass wall to be problematic. you know, having a performer in one space, even if it's a booth off the control room, you know, it's a barrier to good communication and being able to feel the same things. Yeah, there are technical drawbacks working in the same room as where the noise is being made, but I think they're more easily overcomable than people who don't feel
that separation.
Yeah. And I'm right up the hill. I'm about a mile away from an amazing studio called Rig World, which is Peter Gabriel's project. He built it in the mid-80s. And there are two studios there, but they're kept mostly independent. One is called the Big Room, and there are a couple of booths off it, but you just do everything in the Big Room. And the other's called the Wood Room. And that's a really tall space. That's famous for capturing drum sample libraries. It's just got the most incredible reverberation. And I've done some work in there. Console at one end, you put the band and the rest of it. There is a booth if you need it. And so I just took the same philosophy and made a much more humble approach. But I think that's the key, is making sure people feel comfortable when they're doing their work and don't feel like it's work. I try and hide the red light from them as well. You know, I'll capture everything they're doing and go, oh, I found a little piece from that rehearsal take you did earlier on and all that kind of stuff, just to make sure they just immediately switch off from the, I'm recording, and that, you know, all the nerves come out.
Do you find the people that have been doing this a while still get that level of either anxiety or tenseness when the recording light comes on, or when they know that they're starting to go with it?
No, I think it's directly related to experience. I think once you've made a couple of albums, you no longer think it's your life's work and the most important thing that ever happens. And that immediately takes the pressure off people. I mean, I love working with Kate Rusby is a brilliant experience, because she knows exactly what she's doing. She knows how to achieve the result. Her thing with doing vocal recording is she'll just do 10 takes, exactly 10 takes of each song. It sounds like a lot to some people, to others it's not so many. But what she knows is that she knows how it's going to go. She's got the arrangement of what she's doing and the intent all dialed in. But she's got a trajectory. I mean, I haven't spoken to her in depth about this, but what I'd heard when I was tracking her vocals. I don't do anymore. They just do it themselves. But there was kind of a curve, you know, like the first few takes, she's just kind of warming up and getting used to singing and monitoring's happening. You know, come take 6 or 7, she's absolutely on the A game and probably knows she's nailed it by take 8. But then again, to the untrained, all 10 of those takes sound identical. And Damien, her husband and producer, will sit and just absolutely sub-word, make sure everything's perfect and go through and do an edit. But the edits are easy to do because everything's bang in line. There's nothing. She hasn't done some wacky wildcard take where there's different notes in it. You know, it's just, and she doesn't get involved in the editing process. And I'm always surprised that inexperienced singers who want to come and sit down and try and be objective because they have no idea yet that they can't.
And do you feel like you can effectively convey that to them of like, hey, I got you. I know what I'm doing here. You have to trust me.
Well, trust is only earned, isn't it? And so you have to go through the process a couple of times. I mean, most of the people I work with are repeat customers, definitely.
But I would also think at this point, you've established a relation, a reputation that people are coming to you for a reason. I would think there might be some implied trust within that.
There is, but I think regardless of what your client list and your discography looks like, I think personal relationships are what they are. I mean, I've heard horror stories of people going to this amazing producer who makes this work that they really love, and the feeling that's conveyed in those songs is the best they've ever heard. And I'll sit down for a day in under the, you know, with that producer, and it just doesn't click for whatever reason. You know, I've heard some really horrible stories, but usually they're just like, you know what, it wasn't for me. And then the feeling, and this is the problem with also maybe being an inexperienced artist, is the feeling that you felt in that studio is permanently welded to the recording, whether or not it's audible. And so they can't get past it, and therefore that's never going to get released. It's also, I think, maybe indicative of the way the music gets and how the money flows these days. I think when there was an A&R and a producer who was employed by the label, it wasn't really considered how the artist felt about the recording. You know, if it did the right job and it ticked the right boxes and it was going to make a lot of money, then it went in out, and then the artist often doesn't like their most successful work. It seems to be a recurring story.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were pushed about by the producer. But these days, because everything I do, the artist is paying for it, almost everything. And therefore, they've got to feel like they felt amazing when they did it, or they felt appropriate, maybe, if it's a song, you know, they finish that take and cry their eyes out, or whatever it happens to be.
You mentioned earlier about Kate not doing like a wacky wild card move. Like she knows what she's doing. She does it exactly as I would say an efficient way because she knows what she's doing. Is there ever anything exciting for you when somebody chooses to do that wacky wild card move? Like, ooh, I wasn't expecting that. This is new and fresh and exciting. It gives me something new to work with.
There can be. I mean, without wanting to give too much away, it's also, I mean, we play mind games in the studio to get the right result with, you know, without conflict. That's a pretty horrible way of putting it. But, we want to get a great result and they want to feel good about it at the same time. And sometimes if that result just isn't coming, or if I know they've got more in them and I'd like to get that extra 10%, then sometimes saying, do one that's wild. Sometimes that's actually just me trying to get them to loosen up. And I'm pretty sure there's going to be something useful in there, but you never know when people... It's all about ways of getting people to lose their inhibitions. I mean, there's all kinds of famous stories about, like, an amazing producer called Ethan Johns lives quite nearby here. And he's, you know, Laura Marling, Kings of Leon, did a lot with Tom Jones about 10 years ago. And they recorded at Real World. And there was a beautiful song on an album called, it was all gospel songs. You know what? I can't remember the name of the album. They're all gospel songs. And the first song was called What Good Am I? And it's a really introspective song, and it's a look at yourself and kind of almost like you've given up and what good am I to anybody if I can't do X, Y, Z. It doesn't sound very Tom Jonesy as a concept, you know, who's this exuberant, you know, larger than life vocalist. And Ethan, apparently, I think I read this in an interview, I was finding it really hard to get Tom to sort of become introspective. And I think he kind of beat him down about it. You know, he had a couple of glasses of wine and he's like, well, yeah, you just haven't got this in you. And, you know, let's try to do a different song instead. And it kind of, you know, it was one of my favorite anecdotes about, you know, playing mind games with artists. And yeah, it beat him up about it a little bit. And he then felt, well, if I can't sing that song, well, good am I? And it turned into this slightly, you know, desperate, emotional That's really perfect. But I've heard several stories like that where, oh, there was like Rolling Stone is a famous one. You know, they played that with aggression because they were on take 57 and angry and also slightly drunk by that point.
It sounds like there's a lot of psychology too in the work you're doing.
It's all we do.
You do what you can to elicit a certain reaction.
Yeah. Same friend. So in other conversations we've had, this is something that stood out for me with sound designers who do West End and Broadway and traveling productions, is the idea of different cultures being accustomed to different sonic characteristics, that a Eastern European audience could be very different from a British audience, from an American audience. Are you having those sorts of considerations when it comes to sound mixing, or if you're traveling with an artist that's playing different areas of the world, or are you going for what you think sounds good for this artist's music?
I don't think I've crossed those borders very much. I've certainly listened to a lot of music from other parts of the world, you know, Eastern European music and all sorts of things. But I think this, I do a lot, bizarrely, for an Englishman in the bluegrass and old time music world. I've become the guy in the UK that me and Kate's little brother, Joe Rusby, do all the bluegrass music. And I think there was always a feeling when I was growing up listening to Celtic traditional folk music, which Scottish and then maybe Irish, you know, became quite slick, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And I think there was this kind of feeling that, you know, American traditional music was kind of really rough and, you know, scratchy sounding. And a friend of mine introduced me to Nickel Creek. And I was like, oh, that isn't the case at all, is it? You know, but I think what's happening really with all these musics, I listened to an album by a Breton artist made in 1994 last night. Something I listened to as a teenager and quite enjoyed. He's called Dan Arbraz. It was like a pan-Celtic setup. He had people from all the different Celtic nations involved in it. And it was so slick, it was cheesy. I still enjoyed it because it's nostalgic to me. And I thought, oh yeah, we clearly arrived at a level of slick with this stuff. And then we backtracked a little bit. What's interesting sonically is that a lot of this kind of music, even if it's just like, I don't know if you come across Tatiana Hargreaves and Alison de Groot, they're a fiddle and banjo old-time duo. But generally speaking, everything they produce is quite slick sounding, and there's a sonic imprint that I think we all know that most people like. I wouldn't go so far as to say that everything sounds kind of homogenous now, but there is definitely kind of a level at which most Western music and even Western traditional musics are kind of conforming to this certain sonic identity. And what's exciting is when you listen to something like a Bulgarian vocal group, or even quite a lot of Scandinavian stuff, where the harmonies are a little more dissonant than we're used to here. And it's just, it's jarring on the face a bit, and then really beautiful because you haven't heard anything like it for a while. Yeah, I wonder if we're all sort of going down the same path of harmony. You know, more and more British Isles folk musicians are listening to American traditional harmony that's come from the Western swing and the bluegrass worlds and incorporating that, and vice versa. I mean, I'm friends with Ron Block, who plays in Alison Krauss's band. He works in a duo with Kate Rusby's husband. There's a song on their new album, on the Alison Krauss Union Station album, which is very Celtic influenced, and they love all that stuff. They can't get enough Celtic music. And I think the cross-pollination is coming to a point where we're all starting to sound a little bit more like each other. Every now and again, something that really bucks the trend is nice, you know.
I'm curious, you had said earlier about you being an actual drummer in bands. Yeah. And what is the feeling for you of being on the front of the stage, of everybody looking at you from the audience, versus being behind the stage and doing it all for the show? When you come out of the show, being up front versus behind, how's that different for you?
It doesn't feel different at all. It's the same adrenaline rush. I mean, the difference is, you know, if I'm working on a crew, it's a much longer day. No, it's the same feeling. I've never been that comfortable on a stage, but I'm more than comfortable on a drum kit. I wouldn't really be comfortable standing on the front line holding a guitar. I play other instruments as well, but that's not something I'm prepared to do, really. Behind a drum kit, in something like a Rusby's band, where, I mean, we've tried and proven that no one's watching the rest of us at all.
What does that mean?
Well, to the point where we could just relax, you know. If we've got, you know, we're all running laptops for various reasons on stage, and sometimes things go a bit wrong, you know, in between songs. You could just bend down and sort it out. And I used to be frozen to the spot, not wanting to move, because I thought, oh, I need to not distract anybody from what Kate's saying. No one's watching us, and we can have a discussion with them, and it's not going to distract the audience.
That's very funny.
Yeah, it was a real eye-opener and a real relaxing kind of thought, actually. It's just fine, you know, we can just get on with our day. And then as soon as Kate's ready to sing a song, we're all ready and off we go and play a song.
So kind of diving into our area a little bit, how do you think about your ears and your hearing and preserving and protecting it given the work that you do?
Yeah, I think about it all the time.
Good.
Actually, I had a great conversation about an hour ago with a friend who's just a live engineer. He's maybe, I hope this isn't offensive, I think he's about 10 years older than me, maybe not quite. And so he's got that extra bit of time having used his ears. He's also been in louder environments for longer than me. And we're having that discussion about hearing loss, about how we use our ears. And an interesting thing happened when we were both children. I didn't know this until an hour ago. We both went into hospital to have grommets fitted.
Yep, tubes.
He had his fitted and I got into hospital and they, by that point, said, you don't need them. And I came out and I just went under a general anesthetic and came out again. And he says, because of course the scarring on the eardrum, mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm talking about here.
No, that is what happens.
Yeah. Eardrum, you know, we'll change the way he hears, you know, obviously it's going to change the resonances of the eardrum. And he wonders if that awareness of that is what got him interested in sound, because he was 6 years old when that happened. So he wasn't into it yet.
Typically, the scarring will impact your hearing in the very low frequencies, sometimes in the very high frequencies. Like if we're looking in an ear, we can kind of gauge, does it look like thick scarring or not? Because it'll show up like as a white line on the eardrum when there's been a tube. That's an interesting idea to think of, if what would have been an experience as a kid of having hearing that fluctuated, because as you have fluid, if it's thicker or thinner, that's going to alter what's going on within the ear. If that kind of dialed him into sound, that's a very interesting idea.
I mean, I was into it anyway. I was 4 years old. I was using the double tape deck with a microphone plugged in and multi-tracking just by back. There was absolutely no question. My life has been planned from year dot. Like, there's no reason I was going to do anything. You know, when you meet old school friends for the first time in 20 years, and like, oh, what are you doing? Oh, no, I know exactly what you're doing with your life. Mm-hmm. No question. But I, what fascinates me about hearing and age and age-related hearing loss is how there's clearly a critical point that one needs to get into this industry and start learning how to listen deeply. Because we're always at this battling point of, you know, high frequency hearing loss is just, you know,
just around the corner.
You know, it's just disappearing bit by bit. But I know amazing mix engineers. There's a guy locally who mixed an album for me not that long ago. I suppose he would have been in his mid-60s at that point. One of the most musical mixes I've ever heard. And he definitely couldn't hear much in the high frequency area. I mean, all we had to do every now and again was get him to turn the reverb down because he wasn't hearing all the shimmering. But also, I mean, people like Bob Ludwig, I mean, it's not like he's going to have escaped natural high frequency loss. And yet that man could never have done any wrong. He's now retired in the last year. What an incredible mastering engineer. Every single thing he's ever mastered is a beautiful piece of work, in my view. And definitely the best masters I've ever heard. And a lot of those are done, you know, in his 60s and 70s. So I'm intrigued by that. You know, I'm not so interested in learning much about all this equipment anymore and recording technique, but I am interested in people and how my listening skill level is going to have to outweigh my hearing skill level or the natural hearing level as time goes on. But prevention is the most important thing, isn't it?
As you're talking about that, when it comes to high frequency hearing loss, it's generally not that you can't hear anything at a specific pitch. It's that you just need it louder. So if you're in a studio environment where you're really controlling the levels of sound that you're getting access to, and you can specifically dial in and dial out certain frequencies, even with hearing loss, you're going to be able to get access generally to some of those higher, more shimmery sounds that... Yeah. It becomes something to overcome, but I don't think it would necessarily be prohibitive, which would lead to the successes and the quality of the mixing that you're talking about.
And I found that, you know, with experienced engineers, they don't appear to do a bad job. And of course, we're all metering's getting better and better, and certainly in DAWs, it's just, I have a second screen on my setup and I've just got various metering tools over there the whole time. And yeah, maybe as time goes on, I'll start looking at them more. I don't at the moment, but. I still trust what I'm hearing to an extent.
Is there, throughout your career looking at it, is there anything that you have felt particularly proud of accomplishing, whether it's in live work or studio work, anything you can that pinpoints as special or stand out for you?
That's a very difficult question. I don't know. I think I still work hard to the point where I very, very rarely step back and have a look. I used to do like an end of year roundup of all the things I'd worked on that year, but I just don't get time to even think about what it is I've done anymore. I mean, I'm super, super proud of working with Mike and Kate. It's, you know, an incredible achievement to have got to the level where people like them trust me. But I think maybe I think as I get older, my definition of success is probably changing as well. You know, these days I just want to hear a mix I've just done and compare it to one I did 5 years ago and go, yeah, that's a lot better. And I just did that. I just did it with an album. Again, it was the Damien O'Kane and Ron Block project. And I referred back to a record we made in 2018, which at the time we thought was amazing. And a lot of people think that record sounds great. And I heard it compared to the one we just finished and is coming out in October. And it doesn't sound anything like as good. And I love that. I think if I stop developing in that way and stop appreciating that I'm gaining more skills, then maybe I'll become a gardener. It's uninteresting to me not to be moving, not to be learning. You know, I have to learn something every day. Otherwise, this is a boring job to me.
And I'll go back to one more question from kind of our end of things. When you use in-ear monitors, how do you decide what features to go with and what you want in those devices?
You mean the devices themselves
the actual in-ear.
Well, actually, I my in-ear monitors are quite cheap ones, and I think I just never got around to spending the money. In retrospect, given how many shows I've done over the last decade of that level where I need that kind of gear, yes, I should have gone in and spent a couple of grand on a really good set. But no,
I need to spend that much to get a good set.
Well, maybe not. I mean, I'm looking at a set at the moment. There's a British company called ACS, and I mean, the appeal was that there was a 15% off voucher when I bought some earplugs recently. Right. When they're £800-900, it's a good saving. But no, I bought these. They're no longer made. It's a generic made by Ultimate Ears called the 900s. Yeah. And they're kind of a little bit bright, so we just do a little bit of EQ on the outdoor on the board. But other than that, I'd be really happy with them. So no, I haven't really dug into the technology. Most members of our band are on generics, except for Nick Cook, the aforementioned mastering engineer, who's been through a couple of pairs of incredible. I think he's with Change Shell.
Yep. Yeah, it's a very common one.
It's the only one wearing like full occlusion IEMs. And so we can't talk to him just before we go on stage. Everyone else is having a conversation.
Yep.
So, and my last question for you is there anybody that you would love to work with, mix for, that you haven't done yet, but would love to ideally one day?
Yeah. Everybody else. I don't know. It's an interesting world, the folk music world, because you're one step away from those incredible, like, timeless artists. Like, I work for Ron, who's in Alison Krauss's band, who works extensively with Robert Plant, who lives not too far from me. I also know his son-in-law quite well. And it's like, that would be an interesting thing to happen. I almost ended up in a band with a guy who was in his band. And yeah, we're surrounded by incredible musical royalty around here. There was a great band called Portishead here in the 90s. And beyond. They released an album about 10 years ago. In fact, I'm in the process of setting up a keyboard rig, a bit like their keyboard players, because I just really like all the sounds. It's a Rhodes piano and a Mini Moog going through a chorus echo. And I've got two of those elements, but I have the Behringer equivalent of the Mini Moog. And it's like, it's just fun. Yeah, people-wise, I don't know. I'm really, really happy with my lot in what I'm doing and the people I'm working with and anything bonus at this stage. I do, through Mike and Kate, get to work with incredible artists. Alison Krauss sent vocal in for an album. I tracked Richard Hawley not so long ago. Which I don't know if he makes it to the States, popularity-wise. Katie Tunstall. You know, so they're always one-offs. Mm-hmm. And occasional shows where we'll do a Kate Rusby and Friends and invite, you know, some other incredible artists on them. We did an album. Kate's done retrospective albums every 10 years through her career, and I worked on the 30. 2 or 3 years ago now. And yeah, that had just a host of usually remotely recorded stars, but a band called Darling Side, who are from, I think they're from Maine Way, like beautiful vocal. Kate describes them as Beach Boys meets Bluegrass.
Interesting.
The group then were on it, and Ladies with Black Mambazo, who obviously worked on Paul Simon's Graceland album, were on it. Hilariously, that same, the month we brought out that record, have you come across an Afrobeat singer called Burner Boy?
I would not be able to point to the music, but I've heard the name.
I mean, he had 40 hits over here. And he was pretty big star. And I saw him play the second stage at Glastonbury with this amazing band. But he released a record the same month, and he got Ladysmith Black Mambazo to sing an intro. It turns out they got a thing they do when you phone them up and they're like, oh, you know, these guys are into that Paul Simon thing. They just do an intro that sounds a bit like the beginning of Diamonds in the Soles of the Shoes. Mm-hmm. And so the beginning of Burna Boy's album and Kate Rusby's album from that month sound incredibly similar.
Awesome. So my last question, what is one of my favorite questions to ask here, is that we have the pleasure of kind of becoming a part of the story of some of our patients, whether it's with hearing aids, cochlear implants, a specific diagnosis. Can you point to a time where you feel like you got to become a part of somebody's story or somebody became a part of your story in a way that was meaningful for you?
Mike is the obvious example there that, mm-hmm. that I performed with him against my better judgment in retrospect. His final university performance. And that performance is on YouTube. I was playing a cajon, which were brief and popular as surrogate drum kits over here. But that video is on YouTube and it's had something like 80,000, tiny numbers for him, but very big numbers for me and most people in the community. And Mike's amazing, but I wish he'd ditched the percussionist.
No way.
But yeah, to be part of Mike's story from that really early moment, not long after he took up the acoustic guitar, having switched from shredding. But for me, it's the one regret about no longer being involved in education to the level I was, is watching young engineers come through and then seeing the incredible work they do. And sometimes they go off and don't do engineering, but they might become involved in music in other ways. But there's a couple of engineers, both girls, who have done incredible work. And I, you know, talk them directly. They come to me for additional help. And one is Amy Sergeant, who went on to work for the Moloco Studio Group, which is it's an umbrella management company for loads of incredible studios around London and beyond. And Faye Doll, who is now Peter Gabriel's personal engineer. And she works in his writing room down the road in Real World Studios and has a Grammy for the recent Peter Gabriel album. And it's like, you know, she was much more autonomous in her learning, but, you know, I gave her a few little bits along the way and immensely proud of what she achieved. It's exciting seeing that happen. Yeah. Really.
That must feel very rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Josh, we really appreciate you coming on to talk to us today. After talking to Mike, it makes it even more fascinating and interesting for us to hear the behind the scenes mm-hmm. of how it gets to be the final product of what he makes, of what other artists have produced. And it all starts with you. So thank you for telling us about the behind the scenes and from in front of a stage too. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you and connect with you and hear more about your work?
Oh yeah. So I'm Get Real Audio on everything, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, all that kind of stuff. And I'm terrible at social media and very privileged that I don't have to advertise myself because my diary's full for this year. Just a little bit.
Well, thank you so much. And we appreciate you taking your time to be on Hear Us Out today.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.